I'd like now to welcome to the program Dr. Trevor Hawkins. He's founder and medical director of the Southwest Care Center. And Stella Reed is with us. She is the director of community outreach there. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Thank you.
So our subject today is hepatitis and specifically hepatitis C. Let's just start with hepatitis. What is that?
Well, hepatitis actually means inflammation of the liver. So hepatitis can be caused by lots of different things. And what we're really talking about today is a virus called the hepatitis C virus, which causes inflammation of the liver. And it's in fact has become the leading cause of liver transplantation in the United States. It's a virus that was not identified really till the early 90s, and so the blood supply was not screened for hepatitis C until 1992. So really the bulk of infections occurred in the 60s, 70s, and 80s in this country, and actually reached a peak in the mid-80s. It's transmitted by blood products, so it's transmitted by blood transfusions or by sharing needles.
Is it also sexually transmitted?
It can be. It's not very efficiently sexually transmitted in the way hepatitis B is, or HIV. But it can be sexually transmitted. And certainly there have been recently some notable outbreaks amongst young gay men, and sometimes not so young gay men, in sort of cohorts of sexual partners who are transmitting the virus backs and forwards. So you certainly can get it sexually, but not very easily.
How are most people actually getting it? There's a lot of people who have hepatitis C.
Yeah, there are. Actually, the incidence, which is the number of new cases, is declining. The bulk of people who got it earlier on, as I say, prior to the blood screening, and before, I think, people were aware of the dangers of sharing needles. Now we have a needle exchange program in New Mexico and in lots of other places in the United States. I think people are a little bit more careful, although clearly people who actively inject drugs and share their works are still getting infected. And so it's not that there aren't any new infections. There are. There's thousands of new infections every year. But the bulk of people who are infected got infected earlier on. It's a long, slow disease in the sense that it takes up to 20 years before you actually develop cirrhosis or liver failure. And so a lot of people who got the disease back in the day are now developing liver disease.
So in the time before you develop, for example, cirrhosis of the liver, are there symptoms?
Very often not, no. When you first get infected, you may be symptomatic. You may have an acute hepatitis. Where you get jaundice and fever and so on. And actually, interestingly enough, a proportion of people control the virus themselves and don't go on to be chronically infected. In the general population, it's sort of 15 to 20% of people actually control the virus and don't go on to become chronically infected. And those people who have an acute illness actually do better. They're more likely to control the virus.
Interesting. So they develop the proper antibodies.
Exactly. And clear it. But 80% of people go on to become chronically infected. By the way, of interesting, it's the reverse in hepatitis B. In hepatitis B, majority of people clear it. Only about 20-25% of people go on to become chronic carriers.
Has it been studied what the differences are between the people who clear it and those who don't?
That's a great question. And the answer is yes. People have looked at that. So the predictors of clearing include being younger, having an acute reaction, what else? Gosh, I'm trying to think of, are there any other? Those are the two that come to my mind. Clearly being co-infected with another virus, such as HIV, decreases your chance of clearing.
Right.
So
So basically having a highly reactive immune system is helpful.
It's helpful. So if you, being healthy clearly is a good thing.
Right. So how many people in the U.S. have this disease?
Well, actually, it's probably underestimated, but the true figure is about 5 million.
That's a lot of people.
No, in case people call and say, wait a minute, I read that there was three to four million, something like that. We think that the study that's most quoted actually underreported because they didn't look at incarceration. I mean, the rate of hep C amongst incarcerated inmates is huge.
So why is that?
Well, because there's a lot of injection drug use.
Inside of prisons.
And prior to prisons.
And so, I mean, it's, I suppose, daunting or horrifying that the prison population of the United States is so significant that it would alter the results of a study on the prevalence of a disease.
No, we incarcerate more people than anyone else in the world, I think, and and a huge proportion of young black men end up in prison, often for drug offenses, which to my mind is absurd and should be in rehab, not prison.
We're talking to Dr. Trevor Hawkins about hepatitis C. Now, would you call this disease an epidemic?
Well, yes and no. I wouldn't call it an epidemic because it's actually, as I say, the incidence of new cases is declining. It's still happening, but it's declining. So it isn't really meet the definition of an epidemic. It was probably epidemic in the mid-80s. What is sort of epidemic, if you like, although it's probably a bad use of the word technically, is the fact that now those patients those people who got infected in the early days are now getting sick with liver disease.
And that's simply because they're getting older and more vulnerable?
They're getting older and more vulnerable. They've had the infection for a long time, and it slowly affects the liver through inflammation and fibrosis.
The virus, what on a micro level is it actually doing? How does it hurt the liver?
Well, it causes an actual inflammation in the... It's interesting, of course, that this virus is particularly attracted to the liver cell, as opposed to, say, HIV, which infects multiple different kinds of cells. Now, there are extra hepatic or outside the liver manifestations of hepatitis C, such as some specific skin diseases and so on associated with hepatitis C. But predominantly, the virus enters into the liver cell and replicates, infects liver cells, causes them to become slowly inflamed. And after a while, that inflammation starts to lead to fibrosis. So the liver becomes increasingly stiff. And you can actually measure liver stiffness. And after a while, as the fibrosis increases, areas of fibrosis start to connect with one another, and you get a thing called bridging fibrosis. And eventually the whole liver becomes fibrotic, and that's when we call it cirrhosis. And that then the liver starts to fail.
Because that fibrous liver tissue can't do livers do.
It's non-functional, yeah.
Can the fibrosis be reversed?
Actually, it can, to some extent, yes. So if you look at studies of liver fibrosis in people who are successfully treated for hepatitis C, you can see improvement in that fibrosis. So absolutely.
How is hepatitis C treated?
Up to now, it's been treated with two drugs. One's called pegylated interferon, which is an injection every week under the skin. And the other drug is called ribavirin, which is approximately five or six pills a day. And the success rate is about 40% with those two drugs. So not very good.
Yeah.
If you're co-infected with HIV, success rate drops to about 20%. Now, that's in the commonest genotype. The genotype is, if you like, what strain of the virus do you have? By far the commonest in the United States is genotype 1, 1A or 1D. That constitutes about 75% of all hepatitis C in the United States and, unfortunately, is the most difficult to treat. Success rates in genotypes 2 and 3 is more like 80%.
Using those same drugs.
Yeah, but unfortunately, that's a much rarer genotype.
Right.
Now, I did want to say that picture has changed recently, very recently. Two new drugs were approved this year for the treatment of hepatitis C, and they're really already changing the face of treatment.
What are they, and how are they different?
They're different because they directly kill the virus. So they're what we call directly acting antivirals. Their names are telaprevir and baseprevir, and they're protease inhibitors. Protease is an enzyme, if you like, in the produced by the virus that cuts up large pieces of virus into small virions and allows them to escape and infect other cells.
Uh-huh.
It directly inhibits that enzyme.
The other drugs that had the 40% success rate, they didn't work through killing the virus. They had another effect?
Mm. After all this time, it's fair to say we don't exactly know how they work.
Really?
Yeah. Now, we have an idea. And they work predominantly by encouraging the liver cell's own immune system to fight the virus. Now, they do have some action on the virus itself. So there are three phases of response. The first is killing the virus, second is the immune response, and the third is another immune response. So there's two phases of the immune response. And those drugs worked mostly on encouraging the immune response. The newer drugs work mostly, in fact, almost entirely in a way, by actually killing the virus.
Now, these drugs, the new ones, have they become the drug of choice all over the country? Are they still kind of being introduced here and there?
They're certainly the drugs of choice now. So triple therapy is with all three drugs is now the standard of care.
Uh-huh.
But there are some barriers to their widespread use, one of which is cost. They're very expensive.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
Are they manufactured by a drug company and have patents and they're
exactly.
just getting every dollar they can out of them kind of thing?
Exactly. And one of the problems here is that a lot of new drugs for hepatitis C coming down the pipe. These are the first two. In a few years, they will probably be overshadowed by better tolerated drugs. And so the companies really have a few years to recap their costs and make a profit.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons why they're so expensive.
And that cost gets borne by basically insurance, and our insurance premiums are high because of that.
Exactly. I mean, that's a whole, discussion on is there a better way to make drugs than the for-profit system we have now? And it's hard to think of one, quite honestly. And the most profitable market for pharmaceuticals is the United States of America.
Right.
And yet 80% of all new drugs are made here. So in a way, it looks like profit is a great motive for people making new drugs.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there must be some kind of hybrid system of
exactly.
profit and the
yeah.
public good
yeah.
so that more people can get treated. I mean, I imagine that people who don't have insurance, and that's still millions and millions of Americans, are not able to get treated for hepatitis C with these new drugs.
No, that's exactly right. There really is no system to cover people, and nobody could possibly afford to be treated. I mean,
right.
the cost of just one of these new drugs, the cost of the treatment is $48,000.
Per year?
That's for 12 weeks of treatment.
Oh, my Lord.
And that's not including the pegylated interferon ribavirin, which are also very expensive. So we're talking about a total treatment cost over a year of perhaps as much as $80,000 or $90,000.
How long does it take for the treatment to be effective and then you stop doing it?
Well, here's a key point about this. Hepatitis C is curable. It's very different than hepatitis B and HIV, which are not curable. There's a fundamental difference in the viruses. They're all RNA viruses. They're made out of that RNA genetic material.
Right.
But HIV and hepatitis B make a DNA copy of themselves, which then splices or heads into your own nucleus. And in the case of HIV, actually splices into your own DNA, becomes part of your own DNA. It makes it very difficult to dig it out.
Right.
Hepatitis C doesn't do that. It only makes an RNA copy of itself. So it goes RNA, RNA, RNA.
Right.
And so it stays outside the nucleus and is curable.
Very interesting. Yeah, I guess our immune system doesn't have a way to deal with something that goes into our own DNA.
That's right. And the other thing about it is these viruses are actually disable the cell's innate immune system. The immune system normally would be able to control those. These viruses are successful in a sort of evolutionary way because they do disable the cellular machinery that normally controls them. So interestingly enough, when you kill the virus, and these new drugs kill it very rapidly indeed, you also allow the body, the cell's innate immune system to turn back on, because you're killing the virus, which is disabling the machinery. So it has a double effect in a way. So it is curable. Now, you asked how long it takes for the treatment. The traditional treatment, up till very recently with pegylated interferon ribavirin, was 48-week treatment, and as I said, 40% success rate. By the way, there's a lot of toxicity with this treatment as well.
So a lot of side effects. Like what?
Depression, flu-like syndrome, a pancytopenia, which means you can become anemic. Your red cells can go down, your white cells can go down, your platelets can go down. It's very tough to take. And now, of course, we're adding a third drug into that, so it's even more toxic. Rash is common. The good news with the new drugs is that it's possible that treatment duration can be significantly shorter. So if, for instance, if you get to being undetectable by 4 weeks and you're still undetectable by 12 weeks, currently you can stop treatment at 24 weeks, i.e. 6 months, instead of going on for 12 months.
Right. I mean, if the infection rate is going down, but there's still millions and millions of people who have it, this is a significant, what would you call it, line item on the nation's healthcare budget.
Huge. Because, as I said earlier, it is now the leading cause of liver transplantation. It to take care of someone in end-stage liver disease is very expensive indeed. All kinds of things start to go wrong with the body, and it takes a lot to keep someone alive for those last few years. Also, there's not enough livers to go around.
Right.
So not enough livers to be able to transplant everybody. And, of course, those new livers get reinfected again.
Because the
virus hasn't gone away.
Is all over the body.
So the good news is, not only are the new treatments that we have right now give you an 80% success rate, there are many more new drugs coming down the pipe.
Is there a vaccine or work on a vaccine?
There is no vaccine for hepatitis C. And one of the reasons there isn't, we have vaccines for hepatitis A, which is the infectious hepatitis you get from food and water, hepatitis B, which is the virus you get from mostly sexually transmitted, but also through blood products. We've been able to grow those viruses in cell culture for a very long time. What's held up the hepatitis C vaccine development is that we've not been able to grow it in cell culture. It was very, very difficult to grow until just a few years ago, when originally the first successful cell culture was in Japan.
Interesting. So there are vaccines for the other two. Are they, now that they've been able to start growing this virus in a cell culture, working on a vaccine?
People are looking at that, yeah.
Yeah. There's always questions about vaccinations, like who should get vaccinated and for what?
Right.
Should everybody, like let's say there were vaccines for hepatitis A, B, and C. Do you think every person in the United States should get them?
Well, I think there's a lot of questions about the use of a hepatitis C vaccine. One, as I said, the incidence of new infections is declining. Two, it's curable.
Right.
And three, in maybe 5 to 10 years, it may be curable by a simple one tablet a day.
Right.
And so there's not going to be the same impetus to develop that. Now, hepatitis A is a worldwide disease you get from food and water. That's the classic infectious hepatitis. And yeah, anyone who's going into an endemic area should get hepatitis A vaccine. It's extremely effective. It's extremely safe. Hepatitis B, certainly all healthcare workers are vaccinated against hepatitis B in case they get stuck by a needle or any other exposed to blood products that might contain it. So all of us get hepatitis B vaccine. There was certainly a recommendation that everyone should get hepatitis B, and that's still somewhat controversial.
Is hepatitis C a big issue in what, every developed country, every country of the world?
Yes. It's even more prevalent in the developing world than it is in the developed world. But it's global.
And why is that? I mean, everybody's using needles improperly?
Injection drug use is the single largest source of hepatitis C. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And remember, injection drug use in Asia, in the previous Soviet Union, in Africa, is extremely widespread.
So, for example, in places where there's a lot of AIDS, like parts of Africa, And there's at least some of that is being spread through through needles. Do you see a corresponding kind of overlapping graph of hepatitis C?
Yeah, you do. And hepatitis C is, as I say, it's common absolutely everywhere. And it's five times more common than HIV in the United States.
The CDC, I think I read on one of your sheets or somewhere, is taking a plan that covers the nation. What are they doing, and what do you think is necessary for public health people to do on a large scale?
Well, I think we need to identify everyone who has hepatitis C. So testing is the core issue. It is with HIV too. It's estimated that right now, of the 5 million people who probably have hepatitis C in the United States, 75% of them don't know they have it.
Right.
And so
that should become part of a routine when you go to your annual checkup and they do blood work and things like that. They should be screened for that.
Absolutely, and certainly if you've ever had any exposure. And sometimes people are reluctant to talk about it. You know, they tried an injection drug back when they were a college or a kid, and there's a shame base about it.
Right.
So people are often unwilling to talk about it. There's actually stigma around hepatitis C. When we started treating hepatitis C patients at Southwest Care, I was actually surprised that people commented how at home they felt. They didn't feel any judgment, and I hadn't realized that there was stigma around this disease, and there is.
Now, let's talk about New Mexico. New Mexico has an extraordinarily high rate of liver disease. What's going on?
An extraordinarily high rate of hepatitis C.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely true. And why? Because there's a lot of injection drug use, both now and in the past. And so, high rates of hepatitis C and very few people know they have it until they get sick.
Stella Reed has been sitting quietly, but there's a very important and interesting event going on Wednesday, the 5th of October. What's happening?
Mm-hmm. That's our town hall. It's going to be out at Buffalo Thunder, like you said, on Wednesday, October 5th. At 7 o'clock in the evening, there'll be light refreshments served, and it's open to the public. It'll be an educational and an informational event. Trevor will talk, and then we'll have a panel from Southwest Care Center talking about the plan that we have for care for people living with hepatitis C in New Mexico.
And who is invited to come, and who are you hoping will come?
We're hoping that everyone comes. The general public is invited. Anyone who thinks that they may have put themselves at risk for hepatitis C, anyone who has concerns about a family member. I think one of the most important things that Trevor said is that effective treatment is available, so folks need to be aware of that. Eventually, we're going to be doing screening, identifying people who have this. There's a new rapid test for hepatitis C, the same similar that we've been using for HIV. It's a 20-minute test. You can get your results in 20 minutes. And then we'll be doing education and prevention and linkage to care for folks that are living with hepatitis C in New Mexico.
Now, let's say somebody's living with hepatitis C and they don't have health insurance. They could inform themselves from here to the end of time, but they're not going to be able to get the treatment. Is that correct?
Well, there's a lot people can do. I'll definitely come back to your question. There's a lot people can do. You know, they can stop drinking alcohol. They can make sure they don't accidentally transmit the virus to someone else through sharing razors or those kinds of things. We can teach people how to take good care of their livers. So there are lots of things people can do. The next thing to do, if people don't have insurance, you're absolutely right, there's no funding to support this, is to figure out how to for that person to get insurance. And now, you know, clearly if the insurance company knows you have hepatitis C, they will simply exclude you.
Right.
Now, that may change with the Affordable Health Care Act. It is intended that no one should be excluded because they have a disease. And so we'll see what happens in 2014 when that act is so-called Obamacare, but the Affordable Health Care Act is implemented.
And this is something I should know about that legislation, but if they can't exclude you for an existing medical condition, Can they charge you 100 times as much as they charge the next person?
Well, that's in theory, no, they should not charge egregious amounts, but we'll have to see how this all plays out. Right. That is certainly a concern. Now, there is, for instance, no prior exclusion for federally funded healthcare such as Medicare and Medicaid.
Right.
So people may be eligible for those. There is in New Mexico a high-risk pool called the medical insurance pool for people who are otherwise uninsurable.
And if people, let's say everybody who was uninsured with hepatitis C entered that pool, it would be a serious additional tax burden on the state.
Depending how many people chose to do that, yeah.
Yeah.
Not everybody is going to be eligible for treatment. And everyone's going to want to be treated.
Right.
There are all kinds of algorithms where we'll make those judgments and advise people, no, you probably should wait or not wait. A lot of people already have insurance. There we are, Southwest Care Center, doing a lot of clinical trials in hepatitis C.
Uh-huh.
And so one way for uninsured patients to get treated is to enroll in a clinical trial.
Right. And, of course, that drug may or may not be effective.
That's true.
Dr. Trevor Hawkins is the founder and medical director of Southwest Care Center. Stella Reed is the director of community outreach. And once again, the town hall is on Wednesday, the 5th of October at Buffalo Thunder. Anything else you'd like people to know?
Well, I think, you know, we really want to encourage people to get tested if they've ever been exposed to a needle or shared a needle in the past, had a blood transfusion prior to 1992, been in a close, intimate relationship with someone who has Hep C or may have Hep C. Get tested. I think that's the message we want. Get tested, know your status, and then you know, consult with us or with the folks at Northern New Mexico Gastroenterology or other experts in the area who can advise you on the best way to proceed. And I think a great way to learn about how you might proceed is to come to our town hall.
The website for Southwest Care Center is www.southwestcare, all spelled out, .org. So southwestcare.org.
And they're based right here in Santa Fe.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to say that I think that the education and prevention component of this is as important as the treatment. Like Trevor said, not everybody's going to be eligible right away for treatment, and there are a number of things that you can do to improve your health, even prior to taking the medications.
Stella Reed and Trevor Hawkins, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.